Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. As the president breaks bread with a group of Republican senators in an effort to find a way around the sequester stalemate, we'll begin with a look into whether the deficit-cutting mania that led to the sequester is losing steam as cuts begin to ripple through the economy and perhaps come home to roost in midterm elections, when deficit hawks may have to explain to their constituents why frustrating President Obama's ability to govern is more important than America's economic recovery. Jeff Madrick, who writes a column on economics for Harper's and is the author of Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present, joins us to discuss whether Obama can find enough adults in the room to avoid more self-inflicted economic wounds. Then we'll speak with Dr. Helen Caldicott, who is organizing a major international symposium in New York on next week's second anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear disaster. We will discuss the mounting medical and ecological consequences of the multiple meltdowns in Japan that will cost over $100 billion to clean up over the next 40 years, and what lessons have been learned 2 years later with 23 boiling water reactors similar to Fukushima still operating in the United States. Then finally, we'll get an update on the disputed elections in Kenya, where the frontrunner, Uhuru Kenyatta, who is due to stand trial before the International Criminal Court for fueling the violence that killed over 1,000 people after the 2007 election, has accused the British High Commissioner of shadowy and suspicious involvement in the counting of ballots. Nia Kwete, an independent researcher and analyst on Africa, joins us to discuss the possibility of a dispute over spoiled ballots turning violent. And joining us now is Jeff Madrick, a journalist, economic policy consultant and analyst, and director of the Rediscovering Government Initiative at the Roosevelt Institute. He writes a column on economics for Harper's and is the editor of Challenge magazine and contributes regularly to the New York Review of Books, the New York Times, and his books include Taking America, The End of Affluence, The Case for Big Government, and Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. He has an article in the current issue of the New York Review of Books, The Sequester's Hidden Danger. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Madrick.
Nice to speak with you, Ian. That's actually on the New York Review of Books blog.
Oh, it's on the blog.
A written piece in the about how good Geithner was in the written New York Review of Books, but I think we're going to talk about the sequester this evening.
Well, we are, but when you say how good Geithner was, surely there's some irony there, right?
Yeah, well, yes, indeed. You'll enjoy the piece.
There's no question that Geithner was behind the scenes, was protecting Wall Street, going to the mat for them, just like the Republicans are going to the mat for the billionaires. He went to the mat for Wall Street, it would seem.
Yeah, that's basically what I'm talking about. I fill in some of the blanks there, but yeah.
Well, but let's turn to the sequester, because it seems as though the conventional wisdom now is that Obama really got sort of snookered. He thought that because this deal was so bad, and that was the whole purpose of it, that they'd come to their senses before it went into effect. And the Republicans then at some point or other decided tactically it was better to go along with it than to say the sky was falling. So they did a bait and switch, and now they're claiming victory.
Well, you know, they may be claiming victory, but I don't know if they're going to have a victory. They've got to face voters who may indeed, in the end, be waiting on long lines at airports and so forth. They're going to be facing voters who lost their jobs at defense plants. They're going to be facing voters who can't get their educational subsidies and so forth. So it's not, frankly, Ian, it's not that clear. I think it's a pretty dumb group, these Republicans. I don't think they're that clever. I do think they're pretty mean-spirited in the name of tough love, quote-unquote. Bill Clinton used to say that. So while I think Obama has never played this deficit game very well and hasn't played the sequester game very well, he should have tried to get it written out of law altogether. My sense is the Republicans may not, in the end, win this ball game.
Well, they should.
That's a curveball for you.
Sure, but Jeff Madrick, they shouldn't be winning it at all. And I think the reason why they're not being pilloried, I think, is because the mainstream press are taking them to the task, and because they're, the mainstream press is still afflicted by this bogus notion of balance, that where for every argument there's an equal and opposite argument. And it's very difficult, it seems, for people to call it like it is. Now, I'll give you an example. On the Sunday Meet the Press, David Gregory challenged John Boehner when he was lying through his teeth, saying that the White House has never offered up any plans and right. that the Senate is sitting on their hands. And Gregory said, wait a minute, no, they've been sending bills up there and they can't get past Mitch McConnell's filibuster. And then when he was Boehner was caught in an obvious lie, he raises his voice and starts shouting like a kid that's been caught red-handed. I mean, it's pathetic.
I do. I agree. It's pathetic. It's the Congress has become pathetic. These guys got a minority vote. They got control partly because of gerrymandering. They're somewhat hysterical. I think they're this hysterical because they're losing. You know, they're losing this battle. So I do not think Americans are on their side. They may go down yelling and screaming. Maybe they'll bring the ship down with them. But if you think they will, Ian, I disagree with you. I think that they are on the losing side of this battle. That doesn't mean I think Obama couldn't have played his cards much better. But, we've all had our frustrations with the media. They buy into austerity economics, the media.
Right.
It's just appalling. And then they always lump Social Security with Medicare and Medicaid as if they're all equally, equally responsible for a deficit in 2030.
Right.
They're really an outrageous bunch. You know, there is a little bit of good news out there down the road. Healthcare costs have been growing very slowly. You know this, I know. For 4 years now, rising healthcare costs are the big cause of any future federal budget deficit. I don't mean in 2020, but I mean in 2035, which is when the real alarm begins. Well, the projections by the Congressional Budget Office for rising health care costs are so ridiculous, yet driving this highly irrational debate about cutting spending now and balancing budgets as soon as we can. I can't see straight about this, but it is changing. They have reduced their expectations of health care cost increases for the next 10 years, but they've got to reduce them for the next 25 and 30 and 35 years. Mm-hmm. And yet that's what's driving alarm. That's what makes Pete Peterson credible. He shows a Congressional Budget Office document that says we've got this crazy budget deficit in the year 2035, and interest payments on the accumulating debt are out of sight. And it's a bogus projection. It's simply bogus. So the good news is, I think, for us, the pressure is that the healthcare programs won't be that costly, and I wish Obama and those people would start to recognize it and put their foot down and say, we're not going to make any serious reductions in Medicare benefits or Medicaid benefits. We want to see what's going on here and how Obamacare can work and all that kind of thing. So the upshot is, I think the Republicans are dastardly. I think they're not only shooting themselves in the foot, they're shooting themselves in far more vital organs and shooting us as well. But I actually see some hope that they're going to back off some of this nonsense now. You know, maybe I'm as naive as Obama, but I hope not.
Well, I was just suggesting that the Republicans, all of you say is true. They're doing all of these things, but what they're really doing, which is what they should be pulled over for, is deliberately tanking the U.S. economy because they have this obsessive hatred of Obama, and that Mitch McConnell is preventing anything from going through the Senate. And what Cantor and Boehner and all of them keep talking about is a total lie, that they're all about not raising taxes, but that's not true. Nobody's suggesting you raise taxes on working Americans or middle-class Americans. The only thing Obama's suggesting is you close the loopholes, particularly on these hedge fund people. And we've just had the Forbes list of that we have more billionaires than ever. And a lot of them are these hedge fund guys who have carried interests and pay next to no taxes. That's what he's talking about. And that's the part of that frustrates me, is that when one side of a political argument comes up with absolutely bogus lies, somehow it's treated as an equal and opposite argument from the other side, who frankly aren't making a strong argument. I wish to God somebody would get tough in this argument and lay it out on the line.
Well, I am writing another piece for Harper's along those lines, and I hope Obama will, you know, we're still somehow in the shadow of Ronald Reagan, not because of his abilities, but because of the deficit mania. He began, really, by creating deficits. We shouldn't have gotten that upset about them back then, even though he was doing it. But we're still fighting those same battles. I mean, Bill Clinton fought them as well, welfare reform and refusing to make public investments, even when he had surpluses to work with. So yeah, I'm totally with you. It's time to tell the American people, talk to them straight. But Obama was part of this deficit mania also. He believes in austerity economics also. Even before, as you remember, he was inaugurated the first time around in early 2009, he was talking about cutting the deficit, and then he named those two deficit hawks to head the deficit commission. So, yeah, we're dealing with a problem because the American people have been badly misinformed, and the media just do not do their job. The best of them are inconsistent. The worst of them have swallowed the austerity economics argument whole, even though there are, you know, loud voices out there trying to say otherwise, like Paul Krugman.
Well, Jeff Madrick, also I think the New York Times, I think, has been carrying some very important stories, like the front page story on Tuesday about how the municipal bond market, in effect, is being used by private interests to get tax-free investment, which is supposedly for municipalities to invest in infrastructure, but instead big companies like Goldman Sachs and they're actually financing the building of their own headquarters with tax-exempt money.
Yeah, well, the city claims that's a benefit to the city. That's how that works. I guess I've been around so long, Ian, that I knew all of that.
Right. Well, it's just that...
I'm just an old cynical, old-timer cynic, you know?
Right. Well, I'm just...
I think the Times has been doing some good stories. On the other hand, I think they're mealy-mouthed about some things as well, you know, and inconsistent. So sometimes good, sometimes bad, but they should almost always be good.
Right. But I think that what we're faced with now is somebody ought to point out the obvious paradox is that you've got the stock market doing better than ever, and now you've got, 100,000 fewer low-income children are going to be prepared for school through Head Start, 17 million fewer Meals on Wheels delivered to seniors suffering from food insecurity, 1.6 million fewer unemployed Americans serving through job training, education, and employment services. And so on. So there are the two Americas at work. One of them's doing incredibly well. The group that we bailed out after they crashed the economy, they're doing great. The rest of us are really floundering. And that's where I say, where's the revolution, ladies and gentlemen?
Yeah, but how long have we been saying that, Ian?
Not very often, actually. I feel it all the time, but I don't say it very often.
Yeah.
I hate to be a broken record here.
The thing is, there are a couple of good things in the economy. The health care costs have gone down. Consumer debt is now down. Interest, when you include interest rates, the debt service now is compared to after-tax income is now around 1994 levels. But it's the politicians who are holding us back with crazy reductions in spending power. In other words, fiscal contraction. The only good news is it's not as bad as Europe. We're not as dumb as Europe at the moment. But the piece I wrote, that New York Review of Books blog, talks about the intellectual bankruptcy of this austerity economics idea, and I'm totally with you. The Republicans simply want this economy to be bad. They do not want to take a hit in the midterm elections, and they think if they keep unemployment up, they won't. And I'm not sure that they're right about that. I'm not sure that people might not throw out a couple of these guys this time around. So sometimes the people have to talk some sense at the election booth, and maybe this time they will.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeff Madrick, who is a journalistic economic policy consultant and analyst and director of the Rediscovering Government Initiative at the Roosevelt Institute. He writes a column on economics for Harper's and is the editor of Challenge magazine. And he has an article, a blog at the New York Review of Books, The Sequester's Hidden Danger. So what do you think the president is likely to gain from these talks he's having with some sensible Republicans, the so-called Common Sense Caucus that includes Senator Rob Portman of Ohio, Susan Collins of Maine, right, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, even though he's been on Obama's case a lot, Tom Coburn, who's a real economic fundamentalist, Bob Corker of Tennessee, etc., Roy Blunt of Missouri as well, apparently. Any possibility that he can peel off enough common sense people to help him out here?
I think there's a possibility. I'm in favor of talking. I do think something is changing. There have been some Republican consultants, right-wing Republican consultants, who say, we better start talking about providing programs for America and stop talking about this budget. They are talking that way to some degree. And I think people even like Lindsey are thinking a little differently. So I'm not saying there's any daylight out there. I'm not saying the clouds have parted. But I think the weather report, it is not clear that the clouds won't break somewhere in the near term. I'm not certain they won't. And that, I think, oddly enough, is partly why the stock market was up. The stock market would not be up if it thought these guys were going to shut down the government in a month. Doesn't mean the stock market's right. We know that for sure. But that's partly why it was up. I think they're getting a little sense that maybe this whole thing's gone too far. And even a couple of Republicans might figure that out. It's distressing. But maybe we're finally at a place where a little sense can leak into the Washington back rooms.
So
I know you don't believe that for a second, Ian. I can hear it in your silence.
No. You. I'm not by nature a pessimist. I'm just outraged by how our politics have disintegrated so much into a kind of nastiness, and that how the system is so captured by money. But it does seem that the Republicans have turned into such faithful whores and hirelings of the billionaires that they go to the mat for them so shamelessly that I just find it disgraceful. And then I wish that a political leader could step up and make a case for the American people against the unbridled greed of a handful of people who seem to be able to...
I'm with you. We've talked often enough that I'm with you, but we just don't have that person. I don't even believe in his heart that Obama is very much left of being a pure moderate. I think he probably does believe the deficit has to be balanced, or, that shouldn't be able to rise above 70% in the next 10 years. He may believe all of that stuff. He again appointed a Clinton person to head the Office of Management and Budget. So these things are not encouraging to me, but
Jeff, I don't see it as a left-wing issue, economic fairness, the growing disparity in wealth. I think our capitalism is in crisis. I think that these people that too much greed is going to destroy America, and we're on that path where these people just extract wealth and don't create wealth. It's really, I think, a very sort of centrist patriotic argument about restoring and reviving American capitalism and prying it loose from a handful of greedy bankers like Jamie Dimon and company, who somehow convinced everybody that we got to play by their rules.
Yeah, well, you say it very eloquently. I think essentially I agree with you, but then we've got to get on with the process. I've been critical of Dodd-Frank as not serious enough to revamp and refashion the financial industry. It's not merely a matter of avoiding the next crisis, which is what Dodd-Frank seemed to be addressing. It's how to orient Wall Street to provide capital to productive uses instead of their own speculation. So I've been talking about that a lot in my life. I like the way you put it. But still, I would strike people as some kind of populist notion that smacks of left-wing dangers. And
well, you know, the last time anybody said things like that was William Jennings Bryan, and he may have been a populist, but he was also a, you know, those days there was such a thing as a religious left, you know, and he was the guy in the Scopes trial that supported creationism. So again, it seems to be not a real left-right issue. It seems to have all kinds of other political nuances. But Jeff, I don't mean to get you on to babble on here. I'm sorry that I have, but I'm just sort of in a bad mood, I guess.
You're allowed. There's plenty of reason to be in a bad mood in the U.S. And I'm just starting to get a glimmer of hope. So allow me one good night's sleep.
Absolutely. Listen, I love to end on that note, and I thank you so much for joining us, Jeff.
It's always fun and enlightening to speak to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Jeff Madrick, who's a journalist, economic policy consultant, and analyst, and director of the Rediscovering Government Initiative at the Roosevelt Institute. He writes a column on economics for Harper's and is the editor of Challenge magazine and contributes regularly to the New York Review of Books and New York Times. His books include Taking America, The End of Affluence, The Case for Big Government, and Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. He has an article or a blog at the New York Review of Books, The Sequesters, Hidden Danger. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with Dr. Helen Caldicott.
It's the money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Helen Caldicott, who's a physician, author, and anti-nuclear advocate, who has founded several organizations, including Physicians for Social Responsibility, dedicated to opposing the use of nuclear power, depleted uranium munitions, nuclear weapons proliferation, and war. She was personally nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize by Nobel laureate Linus Pauling. Additionally, the Smithsonian Institute has named Dr. Caldicott as one of the most influential women of the 20th century. She has organized a major international symposium in New York on the second anniversary of Fukushima next week with leading researchers and experts. Her event, Fukushima 2 years Later, a global symposium to address mounting medical and ecological consequences, will take place on March the 11th and 12th at the New York Academy of Medicine. It is a project of the Helen Caldicott Foundation, and the symposium is co-sponsored by Physicians for Social Responsibility. Welcome to Background Briefing, Helen Caldicott.
Thank you, Ian.
And you would have thought that 2 years after Fukushima that nuclear power would have been put to rest, but now we have, of course, a new Secretary of the Energy, yet another nuclear physicist following the previous Secretary of Energy, and it seems to me that the nail is not in the nuclear coffin, surprisingly or not.
Yeah, I'm very disappointed in Obama. I had such high hopes for him. He seems to be an intelligent man, but he's totally closed about nuclear power. Mind you, he took $250,000 from Exelon for his first election and probably as much for his second. And Exelon, I think, runs about 11 reactors all around Chicago. And John Rowe, who was the president of Exelon, was one of his main advisors, although John Rowe has just retired and said he doesn't think nuclear power is the answer for the future, which is interesting. But, you know, I wish I could have just half an hour with Obama in the Oval Office by myself as a physician, a pediatrician, to talk to him about his children and the dangers from nuclear power. And I'm sure I could turn him round, but, you know, you can't get to the man.
Well, apparently they're going ahead now with loan guarantees for this nuclear power plant in Georgia that is subject to global warming, meaning that the river that it's on might well disappear one day and then you'll have a meltdown. So that's the part of it that I find extraordinary. It seems to be inexorable. It seems to have a life of its own, even though what happened to Fukushima, that's going to take 40 years just to demolish that plant. 40 years.
Oh, well, I don't think they ever will, Ian. I mean, never before have they had to deal with three total meltdowns. They never got to the molten fuel at Chernobyl. It just disappeared into the earth. They can't remove it. It's too radiologically hot to get anywhere near it. There was a partial meltdown at Three Mile Island. They did apparently unearth that fuel and send it off God knows where, probably to Hanford. But they'll never get it out in Japan. They don't even know where it is, and it's so stinking hot radiologically, no one can get near it. They made a special robot to send in there some months ago, and the thing disappeared. They didn't hear from it again. It went into the nasty parts, and it must have totally broken down under the radiation. I don't think they'll ever decommission it.
Well, number three reactor apparently is so hot that the levels reach 1,710 microsieverts per hour, which compared to a chest X-ray of 50 microsieverts, you get an idea of how hazardous it is for human health, even getting next to reactor three. And, of course, there are four reactors altogether involved in the decommissioning. Tell me about what you've been doing.
Okay. Well, first of all, it's going to be opened by the ex-Japanese Prime Minister Naoto Kan, who was in charge of the whole catastrophe at the time. And it was he who really saved Japan. He's got a bum rap now from people because the nuclear industry attacked him because he became very anti-nuclear. And the American nuclear industry, along with the Japanese nuclear industry, attacked him. But what he did was, during the accident, when no one knew what was happening and the anxiety was huge, TEPCO was about to evacuate all the workers from the Fukushima reactors. Now, had that happened, the thing would have gone absolutely out of control. There would have been no cooling water. There would have been explosions and huge releases of radiation. Fukushima Daiichi, just a few miles away, would have gone too. And what he did was rush to the reactors and say to TEPCO, you are not to evacuate the workers. They've got to stay. And I spoke to a man who I can't name, who I wanted to speak at the symposium, and he said he couldn't. He was put in charge by Naoto Kan in the first few days of evacuating 50 million people. That was his mandate. So you can see how incredibly severe the whole thing was. And so I've got Naoto Kan talking about what it was like to be Prime Minister at the time. Then a wonderful guy who's a nuclear engineer in Japan who's been anti-nuclear forever, and he's now become a hero of the younger people in Japan. Then I've got lovely Annie Gunderson, who's a nuclear engineer, talking about how it happened, how much radiation got out. David Lockbaum, nuclear engineer from Union of Concerned Scientists, talking about the same thing. And then we get into the medical and ecological stuff. I've got a wonderful man from Poland, an endocrinologist, a pediatrician who deals with childhood thyroid diseases, who will be commenting via video from Poland, and I met him in Poland recently, about the fact that there are over 100,000 children in Fukushima who've been examined by ultrasound to their thyroids, and over 40% of them have thyroid cysts, little holes containing fluid in their thyroids and or nodules, solid tumours. This is unique in the history of paediatrics. I mean, I've never seen a child with a thyroid nodule in my, you know, years of practising paediatrics. Now, of those, three have been diagnosed with cancer, and 7 more are suspected. Now, this is really scary because thyroid cancer didn't start appearing in Chernobyl until 5 years later. I think there were a total of 5,000 or 6,000 who developed it, or maybe more. So this is really early. It's only 2 years post-accident, and it indicates several things. One, that these children must have inhaled and ingested a very large amount of radioactive iodine and cesium, which also concentrates in the thyroid, which we've just found out. So they and so they obviously got a really high dose of radiation, so you extrapolate to that to other organs, and all cancers can be caused by radiation, all cancers. And the isotopes that were released during the accident, several hundred, some of which decayed away in seconds and some last millions of years, were all over the place, and people were enveloped in them in clouds of radioactive elements, and they landed on the soil, and when they're on the soil, they get what's called ground shine, gamma radiation being emitted like X-rays continuously from the ground. And when they're enveloped in radioactive, you know, clouds, they're also being irradiated from gamma radiation, but also they're inhaling radioactive isotopes that go to various organs in the body and stay there for months or years, radiating small volumes of cells, which get a very high dose. So things look grim. The Japanese government, meanwhile, is working vociferously to cover up this data. They're not really following up the children with these thyroid lesions. They may get an ultrasound 2 years later, during which time they may have developed cancer.
But at least, though, I mean, just to give some scope to this, they're admitting to a cleanup cost of at least $100 billion.
You can't clean it up, Ian.
What you're telling us about, they're not even dealing with.
No, but you can't clean it up. I mean, what do you do? Children are playing in kindergartens on very radioactive soil, so they get a bulldozer and sweep the soil aside. Where do they put it? They're putting it in plastic bags. Where are they going to put the... And the soil will remain radioactive for hundreds of years. Where are they going to put the soil? They're tipping that the people who are doing the cleanup, so-called cleanup, it's been delegated to various corporations who work for and in the nuclear industry, and they're dumping it. Some of the workers are dumping it in rivers and stuff. The trees, the leaves are radioactive. They come down in the fall. The ground is so radioactive, the trees re-suck up more radiation. So the next lot of leaves are radioactive. And so it goes on for hundreds of years. The food, much of it in Fukushima is radioactive. The government is purposefully saying that children should eat food grown in Fukushima because that's good for the farmers because they need to get back on their feet. It's quite extraordinary. And then I read a piece there. They're exporting the very radioactive food to developing countries. It's being canned and sent off to developing countries.
So tell us about then, Helen Caldicott, the symposium that you're organising, Fukushima 2 years later, Global Symposium Addressing the Mounting Medical and Ecological Consequences. Clearly, as we mentioned in the beginning, it's extraordinary to think that after that disaster, which is still ongoing, and the cleanup, it's going to take at least 40 years, and $100 billion is what they've talked about so far. And as you've made it clear, ultimately, it can't really be cleaned up. And the people that are still there, either living there or growing food there, are both posing a risk of their own health and the health of others by exporting this food, as you mentioned, being sent off to the third world. What is the American component here, though, in as much as we have just south of us here in Los Angeles, down near San Diego, a nuclear power plant right on the ocean, just like the Fukushima were, with a very small berm, again, with diesel generators, the backup generators that could be easily swamped by seawater. But that aside, just repairing and upgrading this nuclear power plant, they succeeded in screwing it up so badly that they've had to close it down.
Yeah.
I mean, and this is a self-inflicted wound, yeah, let alone an act of nature. So, again, I'm just mystified as to how this incredibly dangerous technology continues to pose a risk to us all when it's demonstrated that we simply, as a species, are incapable of controlling this.
Well, the nuclear power has inordinate influence, Ian. And so they fund the campaigns of the politicians who get into power. So all the politicians virtually are corporate prostitutes, and they don't represent the people at all, although they're voted in by the people. They represent the corporations who give them the money to advertise on television in order for the people to vote for them. And then they're reliant upon, you know, looking after their corporate sponsors and not the people at all. A, B, the politicians are mostly scientifically and medically illiterate, so they don't know what they're doing, and so they just respond to their corporate sponsors and their desires, and so the people are not being represented. The doctors are not stepping out of their consulting rooms or hospitals to educate the people through the media about what's happening, like we did with the nuclear weapons freeze campaign in the 80s. We're not doing that now. And it's really in our hands, because this is a medical problem, you know. It took us, I don't know, 40 years to convince people to stop smoking, and it's really working in Australia now. We have plain cigarette packets with pictures of people dying of cancer on them, and that's become a first, and it's really turning off people from smoking, and a box of 20 cigarettes cost $20 now almost. So it takes a long time, and the way you practice preventive medicine is through the political process. How did we eliminate smallpox? We taught the politicians that if you immunize people against smallpox, that the disease will be prevented. And now it's gone from the face of the planet. Same with polio. We're working on that, you know, immunizing people. So global preventive medicine is practiced through the political process. And unfortunately, our colleagues, my colleagues, are not active enough in this area. We're not taught about the nuclear fuel cycle in medical school, but I must say that the best audiences I ever address are doctors. I mean, I hardly have to say anything, and they understand genetic mutations, genetic disease, carcinogenesis, mutagenesis, radioactive ice. They understand the whole thing. And at the end of my lecture, they're absolutely speechless.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Helen Caldicott, physician, author, and anti-nuclear advocate, founded several organizations, including Physicians for Social Responsibility, and was personally nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by Nobel laureate Linus Pauling. She is organizing a major international symposium in New York on the second anniversary of Fukushima next week with leading researchers and experts, and her event, Fukushima 2 years Later, a global symposium to address mounting medical and ecological consequences, will take place March the 11th and 12th at the New York Academy of Medicine. It's a project of the Helen Caldicott Foundation, and the symposium is co-sponsored by Physicians for Social Responsibility. So is there a way that the seminar that you're organizing, the symposium that you're organizing next week in New York, can sort of be directed against the new choice of
No, it's not a political symposium. We've just got some of the world's leading scientists, Ian, speaking there, and some of them said, I'm not going to a conference that's clearly anti-nuclear. I just want to present my data. And that's my role and goal, is to educate the media, who are singularly uneducated about radiation biology and the like, to teach them that it takes 5 to 70 years to get cancer after you've eaten radioactive food, for instance, and the like. And so these scientists, who are just extraordinary people, are going to present their papers and their scientific data. I've got quite a lot of media coming, and we're going to do an editorial briefing for the New York Times and the like, some of the scientists, to teach them. And that's why I set the conference up, because I was so frustrated as a physician that the media said, well, no one's died yet. Well, we don't expect people to fall over dead after a nuclear accident. It takes many years to get their cancers and their diabetes and their cataracts and their premature aging in children and the like and the like. I want to teach the media. But people are welcome to go, $60 only for 2 days of extraordinary lectures and a boxed lunch on both days. It will be live streamed, and if you go to the website HelenCaldicottFoundation.org, there's a place where you can click and it will be live streamed for 2 days.
But the very cause of the problems that you're addressing in the medical context come from the fact that these light boiling water reactors melted down because of a tsunami. And the point, I think, is inescapable that we have similar boiling water reactors
here
in the United States.
Yes.
And we just mentioned how just south of us here in San Onofre, through a self-inflicted wound, the plant has had to close down. And it has some of the same backup problems in terms of it turns out that what we learned from Fukushima was that the real issues are the backup generators that are supposed to keep the water circulating.
And human fallibility. But, you know, those San Onofre reactors are built very, very near a major earthquake fault.
Right on the ocean, too.
That's right. They should be closed down immediately. Immediately. And, you know, there are 50 million people living within, I think, 50 miles of those reactors, all of whom are, you know, if there was a meltdown, God help them. They can't evacuate. You can't evacuate after a reactor meltdown because the roads will all be clogged and jammed. You'll be irradiated and then you'll be waiting to get your cancers. Terrible. Terrible. And
But that's the point, isn't it? That after we go through these periodic wake-up calls like Chernobyl, like Three Mile Island, and nothing was more graphic and compelling than what happened in Fukushima, and that was only 2 years ago. We're coming up on the second anniversary. And again, it seems to be impossible to separate the reality of these ticking time bombs out there, 23 of them, and what you're doing. I mean, I understand that you're trying to get the medical information out, but, you know, one would hope that people can connect the dots here.
Well, as I say, well, I mean, I always quote Jefferson, Ian, an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. And indeed, in the 80s, we doctors and others informed the democracy about the medical dangers of nuclear war. When I came here in 78, most Americans said to me, well, it's better to be dead than red. And I said, what? Yeah, we don't want to be communists. I mean, it was extraordinary. A mass psychosis, if you will. So we started describing the medical effects of a bomb dropping on Boston. You know, 5 miles, incineration and vaporization of people. You know, third degree burns out to 20 miles, winds of 500 miles an hour. The whole catastrophe, and that every town and city with a population of 50,000 or more is targeted with at least one hydrogen bomb. And that still pertains to this day. Nothing's changed. We could have a nuclear war tonight by a hacker hacking into the early warning system or a Pentagon computer failing, you name it. But we educated people. And therefore, it's possible, and within 5 years, I have to say, 80% of people were opposed to nuclear weapons and nuclear war, and that helped bring about the end of the Cold War. So I know it can be done. The democracy, the people, Mr. and Mrs. Brown, you know, sitting at home watching Fox, they need to be educated about this. And once they've got it, the politicians then have to respond to their electorate. If the electorate is uneducated and remains so, then the politicians are free to do their will with the corporations. So the media is determining the fate of the earth. The media is determining the fate of the earth.
Well, as a member of the anti-media or the alternative media, I have to thank you for joining us here today, Dr. Helen Caldicott.
That's my pleasure, Ian Masters.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Helen Caldicott, who's a physician, author, and anti-nuclear advocate, who's founded several organizations, including Physicians for Social Responsibility, dedicated to opposing the use of nuclear power, depleted uranium munitions, nuclear weapons proliferation, and war. She was personally nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize by Nobel laureate Linus Pauling. And additionally, the Smithsonian Institute has named Dr. Caldicott as one of the most influential women of the 20th century. She's organized a major international symposium in New York on the second anniversary of Fukushima next week with leading researchers and experts. Her event, Fukushima 2 years Later, a Global Symposium to Address Mounting Medical and Ecological Consequences, will take place March the 11th and 12th at the New York Academy of Medicine. It's a project of the Helen Caldicott Foundation, and the symposium is co-sponsored by Physicians for Social Responsibility. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll get an update on the disputed elections in Kenya.
But the atoms here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia, and whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military atom, like who gets there firstest with the mostest atoms. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta get together or disintegrate. I hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nia Kwete, who's an independent policy researcher and analyst who specializes in monitoring how international affairs affect Africa and the participation of African immigrants in U.S. public policy. Previously served as executive director of Africa Action in Washington, D.C., and he was the founder of the Democracy and Conflict Research Institute in Accra, Ghana. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nia Kwete.
Thank you very much. It's great to be back.
And the elections have been underway in Kenya, at least the counting has, for a couple of days now. But apparently there's a row breaking out over the number of spoiled votes. The electronic counting system crashed, so the votes have to be tallied by hand. And already the party of Uhuru Kenyatta is accusing the United Kingdom of playing a shadowy role in trying to deny him an outright victory from Monday's election. So let's begin with the accusations of the role of Britain.
Certainly. You are right. You know, the best press reports say that thus far about 40% of the votes cast have been counted, and about 6% of that 40%, the votes are spoiled. But the thing is that some, you know, spoiled is a very elastic term in this circumstance, because Kenyans had to put six different colored ballots into six different box, each voter, because they were voting for president, they were voting for member of parliament, they were voting for senate, they were voting for county governor, they were voting for county assembly, and then the sixth is that they had to vote for just women candidates at the county level. And so some of the spoiled ballots, actually, it looks like people put them in the wrong box, and some whacks are even speculating that the problem might be color blindness. So, but whatever it is, if you include those 6%, then it looks like although Mr. Kenyatta is leading with only 40 counted, if you exclude the spoiled ballots, then he's over 50%. If you include the spoiled ballots, he is below 50%, which means that if that holds, there will have to be a rerun, because under the Constitution, you have to get 50 plus 1. If you don't, then there will be a second round. So that is what is causing the anxiety. Now, why are they accusing Britain? Of course, Britain has a very strong influence in Kenya. It was there for, you know, all this time. Probably you could argue that, you know, in East Africa, certainly, that was the prime British colony. So Britain still has a strong interest and influence in Kenya. Here is the other thing. Mr. Kenyatta and his running mate have both been indicted by the ICC as being behind the killing that accompanied the last elections in 2007. And the funny thing was that during those 2000 elections, Mr. Kenyatta and Mr. Ruto, who are now running mates, were on opposite sides, and they are accused of killing each other's supporters, and they are due to be tried next month at the ICC. I think that Mr. Kenyatta clearly understands that the international community, especially the West, they don't want him to run. But since he insists on running, they don't want him to win. Because if he wins, he will be a president who's on trial. And a number of international organizations have warned that they will have difficulty dealing with him. So because of that, he is also very suspicious whether I think everybody understands, and I agree that the international community will prefer if Raila Odinga wins, because that will not create complications and problems, because Raila Odinga is not supposed to be tried at the court. So I hope that I haven't confused the issue too much. But this is why there is a dispute about whether to include the spoiled ballots. This is why the Kenyatta running ticket is suspicious of the role of Britain, because they clearly understand that Britain and other international players would rather Mr. Kenyatta did not win because he's been indicted.
So, again, I'm speaking with Nia Quetta. He's an independent policy researcher and analyst who specializes in monitoring how international affairs affect Africa and the participation of African immigrants in U.S. public policy. Previously served as executive director of Africa Action in Washington, D.C., and was founder of the Democracy and Conflict Research Institute in Accra, Ghana. And we're talking about the disputed elections in Kenya, where the counting has been going on since Monday's vote. However, at this point, as Nia pointed out, about 40% of the polling stations have been counted. And Mr. Odinga has 42% of the vote compared to Mr. Kenyatta's 53%. And with 6% of spoiled ballots, that could be an issue. But there are, of course, efforts have been made, surely, to ensure that the candidates must get more than 50% of the total votes cast and at least 25% of votes in half of the 47 counties. This was a requirement introduced in the new constitution to make sure that no president wins solely on the ethnic and tribal support. So how is that going to translate, assuming that that the spoiled ballots don't cut into Kenyatta's lead that much?
Well, if it doesn't, then of course, I mean, the bottom line report, the headlines that we are getting with Mr. Kenyatta getting 53%, the assumption is that he's meeting that 25% in half of the county's threshold. I think it is actually a good thing to put into the Kenyan constitution, because, you know, the elephant in the room is people voting on the basis of ethnicity. I know I consider myself a progressive African, and many of us don't like it when people put too much emphasis saying that all the problems on Africa are because of ethnic hatred, and that we see everything through everything through ethnic eyes. So on the left, we are not comfortable with that, and we tend to deny it. But I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. Ethnicity does not drive everything and every issue in Africa, even in a place like Nigeria or Rwanda. On the other hand, it is not true that it plays no role. And the way I look at it is, Ian, it's a question of identity politics. I don't think it's a coincidence that the 43 people who've been president of the United States, 42 have been white men. And so it is all politics, in my view, is identity politics. So in Kenya, yes, people vote according to ethnicity. It's not the only issue, but it's a big issue. So I think the new constitution saying that you have to get 25% in every one or in half of the 47 counties, it's a very good thing to make sure that you have broad support, because I think the reason Kenyatta is leading, there may be other factors, but a big one is he is from the number one in terms of size, the number one ethnic group in Kenya. And his running mate, Mr. Ruto, is from the number three largest group. So you have one and three combined, and Mr. Odinga is from the, in terms of size, from the fourth largest group, the Luo. And his running mate is from the fifth largest. So if you were just going by numbers, and if all the voters identify it on the basis of ethnic community, it seems to me it's a big reason why they are leading. So I think your question is a great question, and I think the elephant in the room is ethnicity, and it was a good idea that the new Kenyan constitution put in place this point that you have to win across the country, so that it's not just one or two ethnic groups banding together to take over the government.
But in terms of the numbers, in terms of the major ethnic groups, the Kikuyu, which is the group to which the candidate Kenyatta, Uhuru Kenyatta, belongs to, that they have about 22% of the population, and Odinga's group, the Luo, are about 11%. And then the other smaller tribes, as you mentioned, make up the rest, and that they've managed, both candidates have managed to split the tickets with minority tribal representation. But I think the point that you made earlier, surely, Niyekwete, is the key point, isn't it? That you have a political ruling class here in Kenya. It doesn't matter who's up and who's down. They seem to trade off. The fact that Uhuru Kenyatta is running, his running mate is the guy that he ran against last time. I mean, it sounds like to me that that's what the issue is here. You have a kind of revolving door political ruling class. And then you've got this vast amount of voters out there in these shanty towns and slums, etc., who at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter too much to their lives, does it? Who gets elected?
I think you have a point there, but I think an additional point is the ICC, the International Criminal Court, which has indicted both of those two on Mr. Kenyatta and his running mate. I think there is it's a big factor. This is my reading of it. I think that's why they banded together. You are right, of course, that in Kenya and other African countries, even the so-called, the ones that seem to be doing very well, like Botswana and Ghana and other places, yes, you've got the class divide. You've got the elites who want to trade power. They want to keep power. If they can't keep it, they want to trade it among themselves. But I think the Kenyans have actually made a strong effort to break with that. So I think my reading is that this alliance between Mr. Kenyatta and Mr. Ruto, I think it came from fear of them being hauled to the ICC. And so they decided, because they've been enemies, you know, I mean, it is, you know, the other, the counterpoint to the elites trading power is that frequently the elites also, individual members of the elite, will have bitter rivalries, even hatred among themselves. And yet Mr. Ruto and Mr. Kenyatta came together. And my reading is their number one galvanizing point is, if we don't hang together, we'll hang separately. So they form this alliance. If they win, it complicates the effort of the ICC to try elected African leader and his vice president. I think that's why they came together. There are other factors, but you know, in my opinion, this was a big driving issue.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Niyekwete. Very, very comprehensive analysis, and I thank you so much.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Niyekwete, who's the independent policy researcher and analyst who specializes in monitoring how international affairs affect Africa and the participation of African immigrants in U.S. public policy. Previously served as executive director of Africa Action in Washington, D.C., and was the founder of the Democracy and Conflict Research Institute in Accra, Ghana. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.